get started here. Several topics this afternoon. First up is a topic that Councilmember Hickey brought to the discussion, or to the table, a discussion of boulevard mowing responsibilities. And we had a letter attachment. I'll turn it over to Mr. Hickey. Where would you like to go with this?
Sure. So I was contacted by Eselson or
Esleason.
Mr. Esleason, situation, and it's probably in more places than just this, this is an entrance to a neighborhood at Viking Hills, and it's kind of the situation we explored with the snow blowing, in that even though that the boulevard and sidewalk abut to the back of the lot, in this case it's at the bottom of a pretty steep hill, and the only way really to get a lawnmower there is to kind of go out around the cul-de-sac. I don't know if you have any diagrams of that. And
I'll show you later on.
Yeah, back down. So it's pretty cumbersome to have the homeowners responsible for cutting that. And we do a similar thing for the snow blowing. We don't require people to take care of that when it's not really adjacent or directly adjacent to their backyard or easily accessible. And the point I kind of made in my original email, I recognize Park and Rec has limited resources. So if this is something in this case it's been cut by the city for 30 years. We've kind of expanded their responsibilities in recent years, Park and Rec, that is. And I gave the example of Uptown, but there's certainly more examples throughout the city where we've got some more elaborate landscaping, and it's more than just mowing, and we're requiring a lot more of Park and Rec. So this, I think, is a situation. I don't think we want to abandon kind of those traditional services to neighborhoods at the expense of maybe this stepped-up service at other places in the city. And maybe, again, I know Park and Rec has limited resources, so maybe this is something we need to look at to be able to take care of this.
All right. Did we still have, or did you want to bring up that, or Mike, do you want to go through your we've pulled up Google Maps earlier just to kind of
move it up. How do you want to go through it? I can do my presentation. We can go back to that if you like. It's your choice.
Let's let you go through your presentation. Yeah. You're queued up.
Thank you for your time today. I do appreciate it. As Mr. Hickey pointed out, we do lots of different things in Park and Rec. We maintain trees, landscaping, prairies. From a mowing standpoint, it's sports fields that are irrigated, parks that are not irrigated, right-of-way areas like Highway 52, Highway 14, along with some county roadways, along with other city rights of way. Along with that, then we tag on the private property nuisance issues that you guys are well aware of as well. From a right-of-way maintenance standpoint, the boulevard maintenance standpoint, is managed in three different ways. The abutting owners under RCO 46, it's their responsibility. City staff mows some areas, and we actually contract a lot of large areas out as well. On private property, it's managed two different ways, both by the homeowners when they do that and through contract vending when there's a nuisance complaint issue. Specifically under RCO 46, the owners of the abutting land have to give ordinary care and to the trees and to the grass area. What that means basically is for the trees, it's litter pickup from the leaves, it is watering periodically if necessary. From a grass standpoint, it's mowing and care of that, along with thinking of the clippings along with that. Under RCO 48, that's your tall grass and weed regulations. There, it really gets into the nitty-gritty of how you maintain it. And as you guys are well aware of, there's issues that go along with that that ordinance. And we're going to be looking at bringing that back to you folks here in about 2 weeks, or at least first meeting in May, hopefully. But it applies to both private properties in the boulevard areas, and applies to us as well as the city landowners. And the current regulation says 10 inches in height, and we're going to look at proposing to be 12 inches in height. The current enforcement timelines are a 5-day time frame for response based on when a letter is issued for violation. Because that time frame, it really extends out to about 2 weeks time frame, we want to shorten that down to about two-day window for mitigation issues. That procedure outlines notification for violations. There's also enforcement procedures that are included with that. We do want to expand that to allow the option for administrative citations, and the storm rules under the same concept where they can go out and issue a citation and then follow the mitigation if necessary. In all, this is a very intensive process from a staff standpoint. Mr. Hickey pointed out the summer maintenance versus winter maintenance, and we did talk about that in the memo that was put together, email put together, that Steve put in the concept of the council agenda. The topic was covered in 2014 when we looked at snow removal maintenance. The difference is being snow removal is a very short time frame. You get a snowfall event, you've got 24 hours to mitigate that, and if you're looking at a situation of this homeowner where his property is around and past other homeowners, you're relying upon them to have their yards all or their sidewalks all plowed up before you get to yours. So it's really a challenge from a soil operation standpoint. From a vegetative management standpoint, you've got a lot more, longer time frame. You have a week or even more than that before you demow your yard. There's not an issue from a tall grass standpoint from impeding pedestrians in the summertime issue. And you really can plan ahead and work with your neighbors on some coordination if that's a possibility. The good thing is most property owners do maintain the abutting right of way. I mean, we've got like 40 or 30,000 parcels in the city of Rochester. We're talking about a very few amount here that we're actually maintaining in the big scheme of things. And a very smaller amount that we're actually notified here with recent change. So those areas that are not maintained by the abutting owners, there's several reasons behind that. Where boulevards are very steep due to ditches, or they're wet due to ditches, we typically take care of those and maintain those. Where the boulevards are outside city limits, so for example, like Overland Drive out north outside of town, where the city developed a roadway, the north side that's still in the township, we can't enforce city ordinance on a township resident, so we end up taking care of that obligation. And historical anomalies like we're talking about here with this owner that's here today, that's kind of how it came about. That Alberta Drive was built initially on by the developer. The area abutting that was not annexed in and was not developed for a period of years. So again, who took care of that? The city did for a period of years. Why? We don't know exactly why. The developer did not do it. We stepped up to the plate. Again, I don't know that. So what's changing now? From an ordinance standpoint, nothing is changing. The ordinance remains the same as it has been for many, many years. We have made minor adjustments in our mowing operations to be more efficient, to be reflective of what the ordinance says. And we actually had a bigger change this year where we had a contract expiration that happened in 2015. A 3-year contract that expired. We took that opportunity to review what we're doing to make sure, again, we're spending our money wisely. So we looked at the historic mowing, both that we do internally and what we hire out to be done. So on April 15th, we sent a letter out to about 190 parcels, commercial and residential both. We informed them of their obligation. That's a current obligation that's out there right now. We did receive about 13 comments back from people out of the 190. The majority are doing some kind of maintenance themselves already, so it's really not a big change for them. Some owners were concerned about the distance to walk, which you heard about today. Some were concerned about the adjoining boulevard condition. Again, that steep slope, the wetness, things like that they aren't used to. The last item there is we do address that. So we make exceptions to the mowing obligation based on our review of is it maintainable by those property owners. We actually make a conscious decision, is it or isn't it. Here's the case you're talking about right here on Alberta Drive. This is what we mowed here as an obligation that we contracted out for. Again, you've got commercial properties on the south side down here, and you've got residential property on the north side of the roadway. So the roadway, the residents on that north side have to walk all the way around. Is it Bear Lane or is it?
Bear,
okay. And then down the hill to do their maintain their obligation on the roadway boulevard area. It's not unique. We have this all over town. I'm going to walk you through different parts of town showing you different locations that we do things in. Essex Parkway, again, on that northeast side or the east side here, we've got lots of budding Essex Parkway. Same thing, they come around here and maintain it or they come through their own yard. Depends on the situation of what your large yard looks like. Superior Drive, a townhouse association. They maintain Superior Drive right-of-way area. Again, this entire length, it's their obligation. This is Diamond Ridge area, 7th Street, northwest is on that south side right down here. This is one area that we used to maintain with city staff, and we converted that about 3 years ago. And only one of those owners actually came forward and said it's a concern for them. And again, very steep slopes behind them, so a big drop off between the house and the 7th Street roadway. They have to come around like about a quarter mile again to get back down to the lot west into the cul-de-sac. This is Fox Valley Drive. This, in fact, I know came up during our conversation on snow maintenance. And the owners up here raised this very issue, these several on both sides of Fox Valley Drive, saying they had concerns about maintaining the winter operations and summer. At the point in time in 2014, when we had these conversations, we just looked at the winter operations. And I know I raised the point that summer would be, they got all the time in the world to make sure they could maintain the summer through mowing operations. This is up Fieldstone Southwest, 18th Avenue Southwest area, and a newer development where they've actually consciously built a patio-style home with frontage on both sides, and again, they maintain the rear property where that public roadway is. Same area, Hart Farm, 18th Avenue Southwest, the county roadway. You know, in this location, the county has historically maintained that. However, last year, it's a good example where the county did not get out there for a very, very long time. They were behind the curve on some other projects. And the grass got too tall, and there was a violation that was called in. So we reviewed that, sent violation notices to the owners. Owners went back out and maintained that. And again, there was some consternation along with that, because it was the first time, I think, that we got called on it anyways. But they did maintain it. They acknowledged that it's their obligation. Left Avenue Southeast, another county roadway, but in this case here, it's maintained by the owners, except for in very spotty locations throughout Plymouth Avenue. And why it was done spotty, I don't know, but we were in there with our mowers and maintained it. And we sent notifications out. We got two phone calls in this area. Both said they were maintaining in some fashion. It was not a big deal for them to pick it up and keep going. Inhap Street Southeast, the homestead area, again, double frontage lots, pretty common that you're seeing now in Inhap throughout town, that those owners do maintain. Same thing out northeast of Chandler Oaks area. Again, both sides of the roadway, townhouses on one side and single family on the other side. So not uncommon throughout the city of Rochester. Recommendations. Basically right now, we're not looking to make any change to RCO 46. We'll continue on reviewing the case-by-case situations where you have steep slopes or wet ditches or problems with that activity. We'd like to bring back RCO 48 for how we manage the tall grass and weed violations to make it more efficient on both you and us. With that, I'll answer questions you might have. I can bring up that other girl if you'd like.
Yeah, was it possibly, or are you going to bring that up, or is Doug?
I'll bring it up, yeah. Okay. So here's the airport's GIS.
People are familiar with that area. We had Google Earth up before, and you can kind of see the street view and kind of see that the steepness of that. Okay.
But again, topography is one issue, distance around is another issue, but again, it's not unique in the situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's jumbled at once. Mm-hmm. That's pretty big. Sorry.
This also has to be one area that we've got lots of complaints on with how we maintain it. People are unhappy with our mowing contractor. And it's a point now where we're saying, okay, we can't do it the way they want it done. Why should the owners just take it on themselves? This is both sides of the street, by the way, not just one.
On the diagram on the left, could you maybe could you depict where the homeowner lives in this case in the path that they need to take to take care of the mowing obligation?
It's 1240 to 1244, I'm not sure which one it is.
1248.
Okay. So again, he's got to zoom out here a little bit more. In this case here, you have to come back all the way around the cul-de-sac and then down the hill. Yeah. One owner that I talked to over the week or last week, I suggest, why don't you work with your neighbors and say, we'll jointly do it. I'll go out there 1 month, you go out there the next month, and you're really cutting down your time of doing that. You got one, two, three, four, you know, four different houses, five different houses that you could coordinate that with.
Mr. Hickey?
Yeah, and he had pointed out, the homeowner pointed out, that there's a section of the first section coming into the entrance to the subdivision that's unplotted. There's no owner abutting that, so who's going to maintain that then?
It's all owned by, it's all public right away. It's all owned.
All right, I thought he had sent me a diagram.
Who owns it?
Who owns it?
Yeah, when I look at the flat map, no one in Viking Hills Fifth owns that triangular shape.
You're talking about this piece right here?
Correct.
This is public right of way. So the abiding owner, in this case here, that owner right there should be.
He did not receive a letter.
Okay. Let's check that out then.
Mr. Campion, you had a comment?
No.
Sorry.
Okay.
Did not.
Again, the expectation that we see out there, generally speaking, is going to be that boulevard area between the sidewalk and the sun and the roadway itself that we get the complaints on. Things behind the sidewalk generally are let go by not just the owners, but those that are concerned about the tall grass and weed issues.
Mr. Hickey?
So I don't know how we want to proceed on this, but I mean, obviously I don't think we need an ordinance change. I think you had mentioned we do these on a case-by-case basis. I mean, I think in my mind, this is a case that would grant an exception, but I think the city should still maintain this due to both, you know, the steepness of the grade coming down that hill to get there, or having the long distance to push the lawnmower. So I don't know how we proceed, but that's what I'd like to see, that this be an exception to the current policy.
So I mean, the steepness that we're talking about that we make exceptions for are really the boulevard area. So this grass strip right here, where if there's no sidewalk there, is a ditch that you really physically cannot maintain. This case here, just like Superior Drive, just like 7th Street Northwest, just like any of the spots I pointed out here, you can maintain it. It's a distance issue. And again, whether you want to or not is a question. So if you choose not to do it in this case here, to me it's all a matter of equity. Is it fair for one, fair for all, or are you just going to make an exception to this?
Well, I mean, I guess I view it as kind of like residential permit parking. When the neighbors want to take action, they come together, they sign a petition, and they make their concerns known. In this case, you know, he's talked to several of his neighbors that have the same concern. They've made their concerns known, so I think we look at their situation, and if another group of neighbors has a similar concern, you know, we handle that one. That's the way I see it going.
Mr. Wojcik.
Mike, the on Fox Valley Drive, have we shifted those ones back to the owners, too, or are those still maintained by
them? They started off being the owners, they didn't care for it, and we kept it with the owners, yes. That was a conscious decision.
We did keep that with the owners.
Yes,
but the winter maintenance is not with the owners then?
Right, okay. Exactly. Same thing here. The winter maintenance is obligation.
I don't know, that's the exact same situation, essentially, as this one, right?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah.
Again, steep slopes, a lot of distance to go around to get there. Yes.
Mr. Bilbeck. So, Mike, do you work with the neighbor, meet with the neighbors and explain where you're at and what the issues are or not issues or what's the standard throughout the city?
As far as
when they bring up questions like this?
When they bring up questions like this, we explain the obligation under the ordinance, and we explain that the time frame for mowing your yard is not as short a time frame as for example, snow removal. And again, they understand the obligation, they just don't like it for the most part.
All right, anyone else?
There's no sidewalk on that side, right? No.
Correct.
So, yeah, the commercial property sits low.
So in this case here, they'll mow a strip along the property.
There is a maintenance obligation for the commercial properties on the south side, and they are doing that, correct?
Yeah. This is not unusual. Again, elsewhere around town, where there's no sidewalks, or in fact, where there is sidewalks, there's been pushed by taller vegetation, not just grass. We do make the owners, we enforce that and say, you need to knock that back to keep it safe from the site visibility and difficult visibility.
Mike, in a lot of cases, are they doing it like a homeowners association? I mean, they're not, but is an individual property owner maintaining, or do they get together and hire a contractor?
In the case of Fox Crop, I think it's an association that they work together on. I don't know for a fact. Superior Drive, the town association, that's an association. Most of them read a single family house, and they just do it by themselves.
All right. Mr. Bilbeck, are you? I was just curious. You said you were going to contact the owner of the plot that the gentleman said?
I will. If he's not notified, I will, yes.
Would you let him know then when you've done that?
So yep.
All right. Mr. Ruska, did you have your hand up?
Well, I guess I'm kind of wondering. I understand Mike's point about trying to keep it uniform throughout the whole community, but I think every situation is a unique presents unique challenges and stuff that we need to be able to look at and consider. So, and I guess I'm open to looking at this in a little different light than saying, well, if we change it, it has to be the same for everybody, because there's no two situations in neighborhoods and with the slopes and with the housing and the settings that are, you know, it's not uniform across the city. So I guess I'm open to come up with something here that works for everybody.
I guess from my standpoint, I just know what the standard is so I can apply it equitably.
I think there's 100 cases just like this in the city, and it's not where I would necessarily allocate public dollars. I've dealt with this in my own neighborhood, and you know, we told them no. That's the private obligation, and it is the exact same thing as this, and everyone survived.
Anyone else? Ms. Means, want to comment?
Yes. I believe there are exceptions to everything that we can explore to see what works out best for the city and for the homeowner. And we have made exceptions, like someone mentioned about the parking spaces. So I kind of agree with Mr. Hickey that we should look at this with a different set of eyes and see whether or not we can accommodate the needs of those particular property owners.
Mr. Bilderbeck, I'm not going to argue or get into that, but I do believe that what we do need to do is make it fair for everybody and ask for Mr. Negra and the people in the park department. If we're going to do that, we need to give them some directional standards that we expect them to go by, and then if there's an appeal process, what that is, because what I see right now is he showed us about a half dozen to a dozen different situations in the city that are similar to what this case is. I'm not going to say they're exact, and I don't even want to get into that in that case, but the fact is what you're looking at is you're looking at there's a lot of people that are going to say that this isn't their responsibility or obligation, and they're going to ask to come in front and talk to us. But I do believe there needs to be a process set up, and if there's some parameters set up that Mr. Negber and the park department can follow before those kind of things come to us, I think that's important to get out, because otherwise we're going to hear a lot of these cases, at least 8 to 10 probably, where he's been contacted in the past asking for the city to take that responsibility over. So I think it's only fair that we help them set up a process so they understand it, we understand it, because they're going to get these questions again, and we're going to get it after they look at their suggestion list and say yes or no. Mr. Wojcik and Mr. Campion.
And I will say, if we do the special favors in this case, we got to take every similar case and make sure we treat them the exact same, which means I don't think we can be arbitrary and capricious, pick favorites or anything like that. We have to have clearly enforceable standards for when we do and do not do this. And before I'd want to make this change that adds significant potentially taxpayer costs, I'd like to know what the fiscal implications of that sort of change would be citywide.
Mr. Campion.
I was just going to say that, you know, ethically, knowing that a few of the neighborhoods I represent are on this list, I would feel compelled to reach out to them if it becomes a city obligation again to let them know that this is happening. I mean, it could be, for some of these neighborhoods, this represents, you know, maybe the reason they go get some of these lawn services to do it. I think Superior in particular, these homes sit up on top and there is a 60-foot hill down to the bottom. And if they're doing that obligation through a homeowners association, it does get to be a question of equity, you know. And how can I sit by if I know several of my, you know, constituents are not maximizing the value of that? So I think it's, you know, if we want to reasonably open this, I think we can look at this and come up with some practical guidelines. But I think a lot of these should come back then, and we will have to, you know, probably reevaluate all of them instead of taking them as a case by case by the new standard rather than, you know, waiting for them to show up. Because I don't want to take a constituent phone call that says, you knew about this in 2016 and here we are in 2020. How come I'm just now finding out that the rule requires me to show up?
Mr. Hickey.
As on this, speaking back to this particular case, talking about the cost, I mean, it's been done for the last 30 years, so there wouldn't be an added cost to be what we are potentially saving by not doing it. As far as process, I envision this more as a simple exception to policy, but if we want to put more process to it, you know, again, I think it's on the homeowners. I don't see the rest of these neighborhoods here talking. Make it like residential permanent parking. If a number of neighbors band together and feel that they have a case, that they have a legitimate exception, as opposed to us going out and looking for exceptions, it's incumbent upon the neighborhood to come to us, much as they do for residential parking. If they don't feel strongly about it or they don't have a concern, then it's not an issue.
I think my only counter argument to that would be if we had a written policy that Parks has been enforcing and communicating to these neighborhoods that have been protesting. When that gets revisited, you know, they've come and evaluated this with Parks already. Parks has applied the standard. You know, how do we notify them that the standard has changed? Do they have to know to come back again? And should that, you know, infinitely watching the council be a burden put on all of these neighborhoods that are affected by this, or should there be some reciprocal action on our part to reach out to them and say, we've changed the standard, we need to reevaluate our situation for neighborhoods that have situations like X?
Mr. Bilderbeck, then Mr. Hickey.
I agree with Mr. Campion. The other thing is, too, Mr. Negler has said that many of these groups had talked to him in the past,
And so he's explained to him that it's their obligation. So the fact is they have reached out, and they've been told no, and they've gone back and done it. So I think the fact that now that your group is here and asking about it, that's the same thing. And so if we change it now, we would have, I think it'd be the only appropriate thing to do is go back and talk to the other people who've asked to challenge this in the past and been told no.
Shaky.
So, you know, we talked as if there's been an ordinance change and now this is the result of it. As Mr. Nigber pointed out, the only thing that's changed is we don't give Park and Rec enough money to do their budget. As they're being asked to take on more elaborate and exotic landscaping duties, this is a cost casualty. So this is something we've done for 30 years. The only thing that's changed is they don't have the resources to do it. So it's not a matter of equity or policy or ordinance. They just don't have the resources to do it. So I don't see that there's been a... The only change is lack of resources. So if we allocate the proper resources, and if we want more process, make it a petition or whatever we need to do. But again, these neighbors have brought this to our attention. Here they are.
Mr. Wojak.
I'll keep saying this. I think things like policing, affordable housing, and transit are better ways to spend any incremental funds we have than doing this kind of stuff. Ultimately, it's a... If we open this up, we're going to end up with 200 more public decisions that we have to make. And I wanted to ask staff, particularly the city attorney, what their take was on exceptions to policies.
As long as they're built in, so everybody knows what the exceptions are, and so you folks know what the criteria are for granting exceptions, I don't have a problem. What I have a problem with is case-by-case, ad hoc, yes in that case, no in that case. That does set us up. For the infamous, arbitrary, and capricious legal argument.
And I guess the other part, I would be particularly, because that's why I asked for clearly written, and it's got to be something like, from the frontage on somebody's property has to be X number of feet to the place where they have to clear. If we don't lay out clear standards like that, we're going to get sued, and we deserve to get sued.
So I would give the example of residential permit parking. How bad does the problem have to be in the minds of the neighbors before they can petition the city for some remedy. We don't have an exact standard. There needs to be so many cars in front of your house for so many hours a day. The standard is the number of neighbors want to band together to request permit parking, and that's the standard.
I mean, that's a very clear written standard. 75% of abutting property owners signed this petition, and we could go down that road, but then is this the best use of funds? Because I'd love to petition the city to come mow my whole lawn, and that would be fantastic, but I just don't see this as being the best use of taxpayer money. And I think one of the key things, too, is a lot of places where we are doing parkway maintenance, it's fairly substantial business districts downtown and the major corridors. I imagine that North and South Broadway will eventually be hit. This is more of a neighborhood residential, neighborhood commercial area that we're talking about. And this one is just pure residential, Fox Valley.
All right, Mr. Hickey.
All right, so obviously there's not going to be a complete agreement here, but I'd like to see if there's a consensus of the council to bring up an RCA just for this case, and then if we want to expand a more elaborate policy. But we're not changing anything. Park and Rec uses its discretion to pick and choose, so there's no change.
I would again ask Mr. Atkins if just getting RCA to give an exemption to this property is good enough.
Well, I'm not sure. Is that the RCA you were thinking of?
Yeah, so for starters, so right now Park and Rec does some and some they don't. We're just giving them clear guidance on what we want done with this particular case. We're not changing an ordinance, we're not changing a rule.
And the problem is, if somebody else comes along and receives different treatment, and then they say, well, how did you justify one and not the other? And I might have a hard time being able to do that.
Well, I would think the equal treatment would be their ability to present the case.
So anyone who can present the case can receive the exemption?
They can receive consideration if they make an adequate case. I don't really think there's going to be a groundswell of these. Okay. But
the risk is there, but it may be a low one.
Mr. Newman?
And I hate to say it, but I do think these things do become a slippery slope. We ran into that a number of years ago with requests to the city maintain private streets. I mean, you know, and we, I think, have consistently said no on that issue. And once you get into that, though, you do need some hardcore criteria to see how these are different from others. Or, I think you do face the prospect of what Park and Rec is saying, where you could have a whole bunch of people.
By the way, Councilmember Hickman, you can bring this up under other business. You don't need an RCA.
Now, if there's not consensus to even bring the matter forward, then.
Yeah.
So I think at the end of this, I'd like to see if there's a consensus to bring forward. If not, then I guess I'm just back.
I would be more willing to see if you wanted to come up with standards to look at something of that nature versus individually.
Real
estate. So if you look at their case and you can come up with a reason that it stays, maybe the distance from access or what have you, I would be more willing to listen to something that of that nature versus a just change it because.
Anyone else? I'm not sensing an overwhelming desire on either side. We understand the issue. We do. I'm very familiar with that area. And it's been pointed out, there are other similar areas around the community. It's a very it's a tough call. But if once you open the door, then you are kind of setting yourself up for some real headaches.
Well, if we went this route, I give it about three weeks before we're sued by Wanda Sykes for some way of doing this. But
Michelle,
thank you. And then the first thing I do is hand this out to the 20 areas in my district that fall in the same category and let them know that they can do this, and it's not a good use of taxpayer money.
All right.
We just see there's a consensus. I'm one. Anybody else? Just to bring an RCA for this exception, and then if there's interest in doing a broader change to the ordinance, I could certainly explore that. I think we're overthinking this.
All right. Is anyone else? Mr. Bildebeck? No. Mr. Campion?
I'm with Mark. I like the idea of looking at some standards that can apply to this and keeping it a little cleaner. So,
but is that what you're asking
that's
for?
That's not what he's asking for. No, I know. I said, Mark, I'm sorry, I'm talking about this, Mark.
I'm sorry.
when Mark said about
looking at some standards,
right?
Possibly do it by the distance of travel or things of that nature.
Right.
At least that way we have some standards set up that we could apply equally across the city.
And that would be more comfortable for you, correct?
Yes, it would.
Yeah, because I'm listening to what you're saying and what Gary's saying in this, and as much as I think it's not, I agree with Mark Hickey a little bit that we're overthinking a little bit, but I also think that if we are going to make it, change our stance on it, that having standards that we can apply to that keeps it clean.
Okay. Ms. Means?
Well, I was okay until Mr. Atkins talked about arbitrary and capricious. And then I was, maybe this is more to it than I gave much thought to. I thought an exception might work. But apparently this standard might be a better way to go. Not only, undue hardship, financial hardship, everyone can afford to have a yard service to come and to help out with that, although there are agencies I know that will come and help out for those people that don't have the funds, but it's hard to not to go along with our city attorney.
Okay. Mr. Ruskin? Are you free?
Yeah.
Okay. So
I'm satisfied, and then we'll just revisit. I'll just keep you posted if any changes.
All right, thank you.
Good
discussion. Moving on. Review of a proposed sidewalk improvement district. Mr. Freeze.
So back in October of last year, we presented to you a tool for you to consider, a funding tool, as it relates to sidewalks within the community. You gave us some direction at that meeting and asked that we come back with more detail, and we have that for you today. This will be the first of three such discussions that I plan to have with you in the next 60 to 90 days regarding infrastructure needs. Today will be sidewalks. We'll be talking about streets at an upcoming committee of the whole meeting. And then we'll be talking about trunk sewers to kind of complete the reports that we've been doing. So I'm going to lead the presentation when I trip and fall. John Wilson, who's spent a lot of time on working on this, is going to save me here. So we'd like to talk about three things today. What's the purpose of a sidewalk improvement district? What are the needs and the processes and the implementation for such a program? You've been handed three things, I believe.
I'm working on it.
Okay. One is a copy of the PowerPoint slides. The next thing that you're going to get is a copy of the actual statute. You'll notice at the very bottom of the statute there's a reference to history. The statute was adopted by the legislature in 1974 that allows cities to do this. Currently, there are no cities in the state of Minnesota that are doing this. We find that rather interesting and puzzling at the same time because it's the same premise on which the League and the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities have been pushing to the legislature for the past 15 years related to street improvement districts. So conceptually, it's the very same thing. The statute has been in place for 40 years as it relates to sidewalks, but yet nobody has done it. Several have started it and have since are no longer do it.
Why?
We haven't really gotten a good answer because most of the people that were involved are no longer work there either, so there's not a lot of history. But we'll go through this and talk about it. Like I say, this is a tool for you to use when it comes to funding of sidewalks. So the program purpose is to talk about sidewalk improvement districts and what the statute does provide to further make sure there's a clear definition of what sidewalks are as laid out by the statute, the type of work that could be included in the program, and what are the cost recovery options. So again, there are various elements here that we're going to present, and we'll talk about those in a few minutes as far as you could pick or choose which elements might be in a sidewalk improvement district. So the sidewalk is defined by statute. It means that portion of the street between the curb lines or the lateral lines of a roadway and the adjacent property lines intended for use by pedestrians. It can include walks, trails, and paths, and it basically can be a concrete or an asphalt surface. So the type of work that we would suggest be included would be repairs and replacements. You already have a program to do that, an annual program. We get around to 1/20th of the city every year. So basically, this is a 20-year rotation that we come back into a neighborhood. We have ADA compliance. You've adopted an ADA compliance plan as required by federal law. We have spot infill for development areas. Periodically, we'll bring to you there's a particular lot or a couple lots where the sidewalk exists a gap and suggest that those gaps be filled. They're on a school walking route or associated with a route to a transit stop. And then other gaps are just might be priorities or for people getting to and from a grocery store or something like that. The type of works that's not recommended is sidewalks and new development. This would not build any sidewalks in front of a newly constructed home or apartment or commercial business. Those still would remain the responsibility of the developer. The driveway apron, the portion of the driveway between the sidewalk and the back of the curb, those would not be included. And we did want to make sure, though, that you understood that in some of rural subdivisions, we have paths that we've constructed adjacent to and connected to the roadway. So if you recall Villa Road, we did that a couple years ago. Greystone subdivision, the
Windermere subdivision that you, I think, recently approved, all have a 6-foot walkway attached to the side of the road and striped and signed accordingly. We're indicating that those, we believe, should also be included in the program, and the cost of the signing and striping would be a cost under the program. So the district configuration, we talked to you a little bit about this before. The statute specifically says that the maximum period of time for which you can charge people for the improvement would be a 5-year period. And we talked about 5 years on, 5 years off as it relates to that charge. Your direction to us back in October is you want to see it consistently, so it didn't daylight on, daylight off, if you will. So we revised the program to do that. We have, I'm sorry, I got a little ahead of myself. So the district configurations. We're proposing 5 districts citywide and a 6th district being DMC. And the standards in the DMC district will be a higher set of standards as they are today. Downtown, we have a higher set of standards. We basically inspect that annually and mark the improvements that are necessary there because of the higher amount of pedestrians that we have in the downtown area. We would propose to expand the downtown area to include all of the DMC district. We then would have 5 districts, sidewalk improvement districts, that would be outside of the DMC. We'd attempt to make them as uniform as possible. We'd rotate the work, as we said, within the district every 5 years. The number of districts and boundaries would be distinct. We would distinguish them by physical boundaries and not across the street from each other, if you would. So we've used the river. We'll use the trunk highway, for example, Highway 52, a very distinctive barrier. And when you see the map, I think you'll see how we've attempted to address that. So these are the 5 districts here. The DMC is in the center in the white. Geographically, they're very different in size, but we again try to make them so that, one, we have this geographic features that separate them, but also try to the best of our ability to make them as uniform as possible in size. So cost apportionment. The statute requires it to be based on a classification of real estate. So one of the handouts you received was this one here. This has the 51 property classifications for real estate used by Olmsted County. We didn't think it was very practical to come with a 51 different cost, basically, or charges related to the classification of real estate. So we're proposing that we combine those 51 into 4 classifications. So in the 3rd column of the handout, you'll see the recommended classification that we're making, or we're recommending. So it's either exempt, residential, multifamily, or commercial and industrial. Why is that important? If you were to do this, you would have the ability to apportion cost based on the classification of real estate. You could, as the bottom of the slide shows here, excuse me, use residential as your base unit of 1. So every residential parcel would pay the same rate. Every multifamily property would pay 3 times the same, 3 times the residential or the base rate. And commercial and industrial property would pay, say, 6 times. And we'll talk a little bit about this, but we attempted to come up with some ratios that might represent a combination of both pedestrian usage and property frontage. So if you think about a multifamily dwelling unit, say a 4-plex, an 8-plex, all the way up to however big they're building in now, significantly more frontage than a single-family residential home would have, and significantly more pedestrian traffic that would be generated by that particular use or property classification that would benefit from the sidewalk. And in commercial and industrial, again, the frontages typically are a lot larger, longer, and in the case of commercial in particular, would generate a lot more trips, pedestrian trips to and from those commercial uses. So again, these we're going to show you a little tool here on the screen in a minute, basically how you could adjust these, and you can see what the financial implications are. But this is where we started to basically try to balance the program needs against a formula that would attempt to recover the costs attributable to the program from these three customer classifications of real estate. So the cost recovery per the statute says that it's or what it provides is an alternative to property tax, which in your familiar property tax is based on taxable value. We believe that, and I think the statute provides the opportunity that there's better uniformity between similar classifications of property. There's been a lot of debate over the years about special assessments, for example, and cities traditionally use frontage for the purposes of special assessments. And I think a lot of people have realized that frontage is probably a very inequitable way to assess for improvements, but potentially on a comparable parcel basis, classification of properties would be more uniform. The statute does not require that you prove benefit, which is a real significant distinction between Chapter 429, which is the special assessment statute, in which you must prove benefit. 434.44 talks about indirect benefit, and basically that there needs to be a benefit, but you don't need to show that that benefit, that cost, adds to the increase in the value of the property like you do under 429. So we're suggesting, as is the statute, that the cost be apportioned by district. There be a five-year cost repayment period. We would provide the opportunity for people to pay the cost in full before it's spread over 5 years on their tax bill, and as a result, they would avoid interest charges and the charges that the county collects for processing. I'll talk about those in a few minutes. That we would suggest again that they be apportioned on a rate per parcel based on the classification of real estate, and we would propose that. So you have exempt areas, and we're suggesting there be some exclusion areas, particularly those areas where the water quality protection program was implemented from 1999 when we started that program. At every single public hearing and public meeting that we had on that, we specifically indicated to the residents of those neighborhoods, all of which I believe are now residents of the city, but the city would not impose upon them any requirement for sidewalk, that it would only be constructed if they were to petition the city council for that sidewalk. We feel it might be difficult to go back against that commitment that the council made that was tied to the provision of sewer and water and also the requirement that they annex. So again, that's something for discussion, but that was something we wanted to point out to you. So what are the program needs? We have these five distinct programs, we kind of indicate work program areas. This is where I was referring to earlier. You could include all five, or you could only include two or three or four, whatever you wanted to do, in the sidewalk improvement district program. But these are the five programs that we think are eligible for inclusion in such a program. The first is the sidewalk defect program. This is a program you're all very familiar with. We go out and mark the sidewalks. This year, we send notices to people, basically giving them a choice of whether they want to hire a contractor to do it or have the city do it. We collect all that information, put together a bid package, we put it out for bid, and then we manage that program over the course of the following summer. And those people who ask the city to do the work are then sent a bill, and they have basically 1 year to pay. Many of you have commented to me over the years how bureaucratic and complicated it is. for your constituents to understand the program. They don't know what they're supposed to do, when they're supposed to do it, what options they have. And to the best of our ability, we try to document all of that in the letters and notices that we send them, but it still leads to some confusion. It's very time-consuming and quite honestly very inefficient for our staff to do it this way. It's a lot of hand-holding. Fortunately, you supported several years ago that we don't allow people to do it themselves anymore. That has helped a lot. It also leads to some level of inequitability because it only affects the abutting property owner. And we're going to talk about trees in a minute, but you dealt with that several years ago about the difficulty associated with boulevard trees and the impact that they have, and I have a slide on that, so I won't go into a lot of that. The other thing that comes as a big concern to people is the shock value, if you will, of doing this. Each sidewalk panel runs in the neighborhood of $250 to $300 to replace. And normally you don't get off with just one panel because they're usually misaligned, so it's usually two of them, so you're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 to $600. That's something that people didn't budget for. I mean, when we go out and mark the sidewalk this year, that's nothing. It's not something they have in their budget. That's not something they anticipated having to pay for. And when we come around once every 20 years and hit them up, and by coming once every 20 years, it's typically more than one or two. It could be several. There's a risk factor, the response to safety. Again, only coming around once every 20 years. There are a lot of defects that show up in that intervening 19 years between inspections. This would be a lot more proactive. In fact, our suggestion is if we were to do this, that even if we aren't in a particular district and we get a call from, say, Mr. Hickey in one of the Northeast wards or one of the Northeast sub-districts there, and there's a complaint, we go out and check it, we'll actually repair it right then and there and basically bank that cost, if you will, to the time that we actually get there, and that may be 3 or 4 years before we actually get there, but we don't wait 3 or 4 years. We go out and we fix it and basically carry that obligation and recover that then when we actually get there with the program in a couple of years. So we think that would be a lot more responsive to people's concerns. And we would recommend then a 10-year inspection cycle instead of 20. So what does that do? It basically takes the current program cost, which is about $700,000 annually, which is funded primarily by a one-year assessment against the property owners, and we would double that. Now, we're doubling it because we're going from 20 years to 10, so we're going to be, the frequency is going to increase twofold, but we're going to be a lot more responsive to problems and defects. So currently, again, $700,000, most of that paid for by a one-year assessment for people who have the city do the work, and we're suggesting that amount be doubled because of the increase in frequency from 20 years to 10 years. You have an ADA transition plan, which you adopted back in February of 2013. It's required by federal law. You adopted a 40-year program to upgrade pedestrian curb ramps and accessible signals. You were fine in doing that. You were within the requirements of the law. Some people would argue that that's not aggressive enough, that's not quick enough. But following that and not at this point recommending any change to that, it means that you need to do basically 250 handicap ramps a year. There are about 10,000 in the city. Each ramp costs about $5,000. So that's about $1.25 million. And you also would need to do at least 5 intersection upgrades to meet the ADA requirements. And each one of those upgrades costs about $10,000. So that's another $50,000. So basically, you need about $1.3 million annually just to meet your required or your adopted program. You're currently budgeting $65,000. And most of that is paid for, all of that is paid for by property tax.
That was in 2013?
That was when it was adopted, February of 2013.
Thank you.
Under tree preservation related to sidewalks, again, we appreciate you working with us in the park department and coming up with some alternatives. They're outlined here in the proposal. Trees and sidewalks can conflict quite often when they're in the boulevard. There's still a benefit of the tree in the boulevard. There's still a benefit of the sidewalk. Again, we've come up with some alternative mitigation methods. And basically, you've agreed to that, and we've implemented those. And but there's a cost to that, and currently you're budgeting $50,000 for that annually. We believe then, again, with the increase in size of the program, doubling the size of the program because of the increased frequency and also the some of the other issues related to some of the other items that are being included in the proposal here, that that would have to grow to about $150,000 annually.
Richard, just for comment, if I may. The tree cost increased dramatically this year based on the number of tree impact or tree sidewalk conflicts that we had. So while we budgeted for that some dollars there, we didn't budget enough. It'll come out of our operations like it normally does, but we weren't anticipating the big chunk that we're getting this year.
bituminous sidewalks are trails, pedestrian facilities that are in bituminous, those are also eligible to be included in the program. There are currently 50 miles of trails within the right-of-way. These are not recreational trails. These are what I will call more so a pedestrian facility. The expected life of those is about 20 years. So recondition 120 of those trails per year. That would basically equate to about a little over about 2.5 miles. The cost to do that is about a little over $528,000 annually. Again, it's currently budgeted at $50,000 and funded by property taxes. Then we have the gap fill program. Again, the gaps are addressed, are basically proposed to address access to transit stops, safe routes to school, and high pedestrian volume routes. Another way to say that is wherever there's a path that's been worn, a bare path or a dirt path in the boulevard area, and there are several of those around the community. Routes that are used for low to moderate income households, for access to work, for church, and for shopping. What we intend to do here, and as we have done in the past, we will attempt to go, and I should say 429, we will attempt to go through a 429 process to charge the entire cost of that new sidewalk in the gap to the abutting property. We're pretty confident we're not going to be successful if challenged to recover all of that cost, but the court will always rule that there is some benefit to the property to have that sidewalk. Whatever cost we can assess directly to the property owner, we will. Whatever cost we can't would be rolled into the program then and covered basically as part of the sidewalk network cost. We estimate there's probably about 3,000 linear feet of gap that could be filled annually. That cost would be about $225,000. Again, we budget $15,000 annually for that. There is currently no money in this year's budget for the gap program. But if you were looking 17, 18, 19, and 20 in the CIP, you'll see that $15,000 was funded, and again, part of that is assessments, and the other part is taxes for those portions that could not be assessed. So what does that, all of that mean? It means a lot in the form of money. So again, it's about a $3.6 million annual need. 40% of that would be the sidewalk defect repair program. The ADA transition program would be about 36% of that. The tree preservation is 4%. The right-of-way trail preservation is 15%, and the priority gaps are about 6%. The 2016 budget addresses about 10% of that need. There's $350,000 in this year's budget. Property taxes pays for $250,000 of that, and the assessments to the private property owners pays for another $100,000. So I talked about cross-property classification. This is kind of how the numbers break down on the four recommended real estate groups. This sheet, actually, the sheet that shows 51, has all of the individual breakdowns that the county has, as you see. But what we've done here is basically grouped them into four. So this is reflective of that. The exemptions, the residential about 30, a little over 35,000, a multifamily not quite 1,000, and the commercial industrial just short of 4,000. So again, it's, we could do all 51. I would ask that if you were to give us direction to move forward, that we try to consolidate some of those. We felt that these that the 51 kind of fell nicely into these four categories. So here's, and this, we can make this an interactive slide here. This was our attempt to look at what would it take, how much money would have to be collected in order to fund the $3.6 million. So you see the district summary out here. Here were the districts that we came up with. We gave them a name geographically, and we looked at the residential equivalents here. So remember, I had a slide that said we'd try to be as uniform as we can. It didn't work out as well in all of the districts. That just made it worse. But so again, we can tweak on that if that's a concern to you. But you know, it's, there's a range there, and again, our, the best case scenario would have been there would have been an equivalent number of residentials. I don't think that's that big a deal, but we could talk about it if you wanted to. The other thing then we looked at is we have the multipliers. So I talked about the multipliers here for the various classifications. And then we basically can, and we can basically put a cost in here, a cost per month, and it will calculate this number based on however we change this. So we've looked at this a number of different ways. We've had 1, 5, and 8 and different things. That's ultimately going to be a decision that if you wanted to move forward, you would have to, we would want you to be involved. But it's $6 a month for a residential, it's 12 monthly payments, or 12 payments, that's $72,000 for 5 years. The county collects a fee for every year for putting it on the tax bill. So if you were to pay in full, you'd pay $280, and we'd give you that option. If you wanted it on your property tax bill, you'd see it basically coming across as basically $72 a year, so $36 every each of your two tax statements that you get. And this would be for residential. So we can change that to... why don't we change the multipliers, John, just show maybe how that works. So we can change that to 5 and this to 8, for example. And it generates a whole bunch more money. So now we could reduce this probably to about $4 or $4.50. And so somehow that didn't quite get us there. So let's try 5. But you can, I guess you get the point. So we're not quite at 3.6. And I understand that 3.6 may not be where we need to start with this the program that you could phase in. But just wanted to show you we have this calculator, so if there are later some questions about, well, what if we did this and what if we did that, if the multiplier was the same for everybody, why don't you just put that one up there, why don't you just put it 111 for everyone? If everybody paid the same regardless of property classification, basically the monthly would probably have to go to 10. That's a little much, so you can probably get about 9. So that'd be pretty close. So you can just see how we can do it. But you have the ability under the statute to basically apportion cost by the property classification, and 111 doesn't do that. But I don't think that you would have a problem if you wanted to do that. Let me keep going here and talk a little bit more about the rest of the slides. And then, so again, just refreshing your memory here, we've got the 5 districts plus the DMC district. In the DMC, our intent would basically would be to continue to do an annual inspection. again, with the number of pedestrians that we have in our downtown area, and the DMC district really is the downtown plus the same areas and the connection along 2nd Street, so it's not that much different, but we think that an annual inspection there is still going to be required. So process and implementation. We would need an ordinance in order to for this to happen. We've already got an initial start on an ordinance that we would share with the city attorney if you were to give us such direction. We'd need formal adoption and approval of the district boundaries and the cost recovery rates. My opinion is that if you want to do this, you need to commit to it for 10 years. It will take us 10 years to get to the whole city. And so if you were to start, and we're actually going to start, suggest we start in Southwest, because that's kind of where our rotation is right now, is that would be the next area under our current program that we would start, would be in Southwest, that you need to go all the way through, and basically you're going through each district, each of the five, if you could then reduce like that, each of the five districts, each of the five colored areas, you're going to go through that twice, because we're only going to do half at a time. That's the way the assessment keeps going, or the cost recovery keeps going every 5 years. But we wouldn't inspect the whole geographic area every 5 years. We'd do half in 2016, we'd do the other half in 2021. And for 2017, implementation. Now, there's nothing that says you have to implement this in 2017. If this is moving too fast, we just need to know, because we need to have a 2017 program, and it will either be similar to what we're doing now, or it will be something new. But we need to kind of have that direction from you by June, because one way or the other, we've got to have a sidewalk program next year. The size and shape of it, and where we, and what's included would be different, but. If this is schedule is too aggressive, and I've got the next slide here is actually a more detailed schedule. If basically adopting ordinances and resolutions in June and selecting districts for improvements, again, we're going to recommend Southwest District Section A for 2017. We would move them through staff inspections for defects in July through September. Basically putting together the program, preparing the plans and specifications in October through January, putting it out for bid, and doing the construction next year, May to September. After the construction is, or in August, then we do a post-construction portioning and send payment notifications to the property owners, and basically giving them the opportunity to pay before November 15th. And if they pay, they don't have to pay then the 5 years worth of interest isn't included in their bill, or the $7.50 that the county charges for including it on the tax bill. We would then send whatever parcels hadn't paid by November 15th to the county for collection over the next 5 years. And then 5 years from now, we'd be back in June of 2021 to basically start doing the inspections in the second half of the Southwest District. So each year we'd be in a different district. Every 5 years we're going to be back in that same district. So again, as I mentioned earlier, if there was a major defect or something that occurred in Northeast and we're not getting there for three more years, we'd still make that repair now, just hold and carry that cost and recover it then when we got there in 3 years. So that's the end of the formal presentation. A lot of information, a lot more detail that we've prepared for you. I'd be happy to answer any questions and take some direction at this point.
Well, first, let me say thank you. It's a very, very good analysis. I really like how you've tried to make this dynamic and present some choices. One of the observations, and you mentioned it in your opening comments, this is one of, I think, three presentations you'll be making, and it occurs to me whether we should be looking at this a bit more holistically. I mean, this is one potential issue, and the sidewalk improvement. We know we've got a couple of others on the horizon, and I realize that while in this particular case you have up on the screen, $70 a year, might not seem like a lot, but then as we start to add in some of the other fees, I start to get a little concerned that it'll be, it starts to add up, quite frankly. So that, but that's just an observation.
This is a tool, and it's a tool that you have to have courtesy of the legislature. And I think we have to decide whether it's something that we want to use in lieu of property tax, because on this particular slide that I've had you put back up, everything on here except the very first one is basically property tax supported. So your ADA transition plan, your tree preservation, your right-of-way trail preservation, and your priority gaps, with the exception of the portion of that that we can try to assess directly to the property owner where the gap is pretty much all property tax. Under the sidewalk defect repair program, you pay a considerable portion of that also, because there are city parcels and things like that. So if we take the 1.4 off the top, for example, and just say we're going to recover that under our current program by charging people with their, for their sidewalk defects at whatever frequency that might be, you still have a $2.2 million gap there that to be funded by property tax. And when you're only putting in $250,000, again, you're still only funding 10% of the property tax obligation. So that's why we're here to talk to you about this, because we don't know how else to get there. I realize the struggles that you have with the CIP. Stephen talks to you about it. He talks to us about it, you know, about the little room that we have in the CIP to put more dollars. But this is just one of, this and streets are the two from public works perspective that impact the CIP. So I respect your point is that these numbers here will be small in comparison to when we come with the street numbers. I'll just...
Right, and I'm not faulting anything you presented. It just, as we look at the bigger picture, we have to keep that in mind. Another common refrain that we hear is as we start to break things out of the property tax, then, you know, the ability to write off and things like that on personal income taxes becomes a factor. So
I'd like to just address that if I could. I understand that point. But so here for $72 a year, actually it's not 72, it's actually about 56 of actual cost. How much of that can you actually write off? It depends on which tax bracket you're in. Depends on if you claim exemptions or not. So I mean, it's either 15% or it's 28% or it's 31%, but it's, you're not writing off that full $56. Nobody can.
Agreed.
Right. So, but I understand you hear that comment, but when you put it into real perspective, it's not a big portion of it that you can write off.
Okay, Mr. Woodjack.
Well, I'm just following up on that. I was just curious with it being on the tax bill, it is truly not deductible then, right?
I don't know. I'm not a tax attorney, but I don't think it would be. I don't. It's not an assessment. Well, actually, it is an assessment if it goes on the tax bill. It's a five-year assessment. They're agreeing to be assessed for 5 years. So at least for residential property owners, it's not an eligible deduction.
I was just curious about
you'll,
that.
You'll get different opinions from tax attorneys and consultants on whether the commercial and industrial property can deduct it as a business expense. Operating expense.
Okay, Mr. Campion?
So one of the things you mentioned is we won't build new sidewalks, but having recently kind of established a new set of criteria for roadways and inspection before we take ownership of those, has there been a historical reason? I guess I've noticed as I've gone around, in particular, as I've got some of those sticker shock phone calls from constituents that entire rows of their sidewalk will have failed, and one neighbor's sidewalks will be failed, and the next neighbor who lives, you know, 100 feet away will have no failures. Is there something to the contractual quality of the sidewalk and when it is built that we should be cognizant of with our rules?
It's a workmanship thing, typically, and it's a lot like the problems that we found in our investigation and report to you on the streets. It's the preparation of the soil, the subgrade before the concrete is poured. The concrete in almost all cases itself, the cement is not inferior. It's the method of either placement or the base on which it's constructed.
So would we have equivalent safeguards in place for taking ownership of these sidewalks?
Every new sidewalk built as part of a new development is to be done under a permit. You approve permit fees for that, right. And which require an inspection and the payment of that. So we believe that there are the proper tools in place, if proper safeguards against that. But there's always going to be situations. I think the most problems we have on new sidewalks and new subdivisions is a settlement occurs where the sewer and water lateral went into the house.
Right.
Because that's now on private property or getting very close to private property. So the compaction requirements weren't again, it's private property. We don't have any control there. And that's typically, I think, where we see a lot of the failures on new sidewalks and new subdivisions is where the utility trench went into the house.
However, about 10 years ago, we tried to address that very thing by requiring the city owner contract to bring those service lines 10 feet into the property. And I think that in that time frame, we're seeing less and less of that particular problem than we had before.
Used to be they went right to the property line, and then that actually was right to the edge of the sidewalk, and that in and of itself created some problems.
So when we find those repeated things, we are adopting
changes to the process to try to remedy it.
Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, going back to the cost apportionment, and you'd mentioned on the use of the multiplier that, you know, it's just a variable. We could choose to make it one, but it just seems so much of these defective panels would either be root heave or settling as opposed to, like, trip generation causing wear. So it seems like the difference between a residential or a multifamily, the multiplier doesn't seem like the trip generation would really, justify that multiplier.
I think you could make an argument that it could be higher or lower. I think it's just, and again, we're not set on any of these. I think the council has to feel some comfort level. But we've kind of looked at the two criteria you probably should look at is how many trips might be generated and what's maybe a way to look at the difference in frontage that may exist in these big, broad categories here. Again, we've tried to combine, a commercial property can have a frontage as narrow as 22 feet and as long as 2,200 feet or 2.5, So it's trying to put them in a few buckets and say that it's proportional. For the transportation improvement districts, for example, I think we have five classifications, different multipliers for that based on, again, zoning was the thing we used there. Because zoning was basically a real indicative of the number of trips that would be generated by a piece of property. Not every property generated the same number of trips based on B4 zoning, but again, it was recognized that they could and had the potential to do that.
Mr. Ruskin.
I guess I'm just a little bit, I want some clarity on this commercial industrial. As an example, you've got 3,990 properties. Does that mean that they'd all pay the same amount?
Yes.
So you got Ma and Pa's Diner sitting there with, 20 feet of frontage and Target Superstore.
Yep.
They're going to pay the same. And the same with residential. If you've got $1 million home or $100,000 home, they pay the same.
So again, you can make it as complicated as you want to. You can make it as simple as you want. We started with simple.
Right.
Which is not really something we don't do.
All right. We got a little problem with that. Right. I just think that's,
Again, there were some things that we talked about. You base it on value, for example. Do you look at the value of the property? And so if, and Dale has given me some information earlier today that basically talked about the, the class rates that the state uses for property. So for example, for residential, you could have a difference, commercial, if it's over $150,000 or if it's less than $150,000. That's a class rate distinction that the state makes as it relates to property taxes. You could do things like that. I think, again, what we're looking for is this a tool you want? Because we can continue to work on it. We can continue to tweak it to address some of your concerns. but if you're not interested at all, I think, you know, it's time for us to put it to bed for a while. And like I say, if this getting it ready for next year is too soon, then, but you're still interested and want to do it for 2018, that's fine too. We just kind of need a direction in the next couple months as to which way we go for next year's program.
Okay. We've run various scenarios looking at these three classification groups, frontage, area, value, and you can support all kinds of numbers if you want to pick one of those. So 1-to-1 and up to 1-to-10 on the commercial, all of those you can justify by a calculation if you wish to do so. So it's somewhere in here that feels right, I think, is the key. We just have to use this property classification to define which group they're in, and then each one in that group must get the same cost because of the way the statute's written.
I'm not going to put Terry on the spot here, and he can comment if he likes, but I think that as long as you've had this discussion about apportionment and you've come to some agreement on what is fair and equitable, I think you're going to be okay if challenged. But you need to have that conversation, and you need to basically, the policy needs to address how and why you chose to apportion the way you did.
Articulate your rationale.
Right, and it's basically you have that discretionary ability to do that as long as you
can articulate your rationale.
Mr. Campion?
So I think that this tool is going to be necessary. Having dealt with a number of property owners that get assessments for 3 to 4 panels, a shock $1,200 bill, a lot of families just cannot absorb that. And I think this really kind of gets to the heart of taking something that is a shock, a sticker shock problem, and trying to help people, you know, afford it over a couple of years is something that we have this process set up to do. You know, how to make, I'm open to discussing the multipliers for the different classes, the idea of maybe taking some of the tax classes and using those. Both of those ideas to me sound necessary, but I do think that there is a distinction between a residential home and a subdivision and a commercial property. They've moved into commercial zoning. They understand that difference. And so I do see justification for different multipliers for the different areas. And certainly multifamily, you're going to see some more foot traffic probably than you get with a single family home. So I think there's a good reason to look at this. The tool and the stuff you presented is promising. I do have some other questions I'd like to ask already. So the other one is, you said you'd be going around off cycle to address some repairs. I'm assuming that a tool like this will enable us to maybe use some different repair strategies than what we traditionally have, kind of rip and replace. Will we be able to leverage? I've seen like mud jacking and a few other things going on in different areas. I assume we would try and make the most affordable repair solution available to kind of optimize this cycle.
I would think that what we would do is we would look at alternatives to basically buy some time. So in other words, and we don't really support mud jacking and we don't support grinding, but we may find that, and one of the reasons we don't is because of, the lack of inspection, the lack of consistency in how it gets done. So I've seen people that have ground that lip off and basically it's like a quarter, like a quarter round, on the baseboard versus some people who will basically bevel it all the way back, 2 or 3 inches. So I think we could look at that and we would exercise our discretion, basically make the repair in the most cost-effective manner, realizing the fact that in 3 years we might be back there to pull the full panel.
And that was another reason that this looked promising to me is we're staff in the city now are taking responsibility for the system.
Right.
So it's no longer, some sections are getting one repair method, other sections are getting another. Generally, we're applying the same repair strategy throughout, and I think that's promising. Why exempt federal and state properties? I have one state property.
Because we want to, because we have to.
Oh.
Cover cost.
You won't get the money.
that's too bad, because I know that these, I can imagine these places have people walking. That's too bad.
When we tried to, when we put the new path in front of FMC, for example, we told them this was their cost, and I said, sorry, try and collect.
So can we just, so can we just not, if they're not part of the system, I'm going to suggest that. $1.3 million is over the annual anticipated cost. Is that because we are not currently doing the appropriate amount, we're correct? Sorry, for the ADA transition, it looks like
You're just not able to afford in your budget to put enough money in. Now, again, I think you have some discretion there. You've got a 40-year plan, and if you're off a year or two here or there and are doing 1/40th, I don't think you're going to have any real big problems with that. But if for 10 years in a row you're only budgeting 1/10 of what you need, you got to pay the piper one way.
And I guess what I'm getting at is this 40-year plan, for the last 3 years, we've been putting in 1/10 of what's necessary. And so we're having to factor that in over 40
years. You adopted a 40-year plan, but you haven't funded a 40-year plan.
Right, yeah. No, I get that. Unfunded mandates from previous councils, right?
And
then,
it's a federal mandate.
I'm just giving them a hard time.
Well, kicking the can down the road, though.
In the interest of time, what direction would we like to give staff at this point? I mean, obviously we're not going to solve it today, but Swojak?
Well, this was a fantastic presentation. You can tell how great a presentation is by the number of pages of questions that I write down. And I have just a number of great, you know, questions based on the information that was presented. Kind of some big picture things. I like how this came with kind of some tentative staff recommendations, because, you know, you can make a lot of this whole business versus commercial versus multifamily is maybe a, I'd like to follow the direction of some professional expertise as opposed to battling that one out on our own, perhaps. I do think that important thing to remember here is, for the most part, these are things that we kind of have to do, and we're not budgeting for it. And, I mean, there's really three options. You can keep not doing stuff. You can stick it in the property taxes, which I think is just brutally unfair to businesses, particularly those in high-value locations. Or you can take the utility approach. And I think of those three, the utility approach is the fairest of them all. And I have so many questions, I'm just going to try and meet with staff separately, go through some of the nuts and bolts.
So let me make sure that I... So I'm not sure. So 3.6 is what we've identified as the need. And as I said before, you don't have to get there all at once if you don't want to. So maybe the first cycle through, if you will, basically you set the annual budget and you say it's going to be $2 million, okay? And the second cycle through, you know, we're going to phase into this, if you will. It's just a matter of having a plan and having a strategy on how you're going to get there. Mm-hmm. And I know when I come and talk to you about streets and sewers, it's going to be the same thing. There's going to be sticker shock. But we don't have to get there all in 1 year and all in that first cycle. So I think it's more the concept. Do you like the concept? Is it something you want to use? Is it a tool that helps you with some of the challenges you have with the tax levy? And you can tell us the size of the program you want. You could go to $3 and put the multipliers of 1, 3, and 6, generate $1.6 million worth of revenue the first time through. Yeah, we're not going to be able to do anything, but this sets our budget. So this is how much work then that we basically identify. So when we get to that point, if that's the number of defects, or that's the number of ADA ramps, or that's the number of this or that, that's all we can do. So I just want to make sure that you understood that you don't have to get to the ultimate goal the first time around if you don't want to.
Right. Okay. I'm hearing that some people might have some questions, and I appreciate that. My only thought would be, if we have questions, please share those with the group and the responses so that we can all stay educated. questions, comments? Where would you like
to go? Maybe a couple bigger picture ones that you know, the group would probably be interested in. When we do the gap fill, are we going to try and do that by assessment and fill in what we can't get by assessment if we're challenged with this program? Or,
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That, so
we
that would
try
be,
to recover everything that, we can through the benefits.
That would extend that out greatly. And then on the ADA, are the requirements for the ramp starting to stabilize right now? Because one of the issues has been for a long time, you do a ramp and then 10 years later it's obsolete. But it seems, I'm hearing those standards have started to come into more stabilized.
Yeah, the truncated domes, you know,
they
kind of messed around with how to do that. And I think the federal folks are pretty well set on truncated domes.
And the only thing
seems to be the
okay. Train. Oh, and that's, as long as they're stabilized, that's good to know because it does help us in the long run. My concern is if we consistently underfund our ADA transition plan, which we've been forced to do for quite some time here, are we liable for litigation over that directly or possibly as some of this disparate outcomes?
Or discretionary immunity if you're deciding you've got money
for a while, probably. You can probably fall back in discretionary immunity for a while.
Okay.
But I think sooner or later, when you have an identified obligation of whatever it might be, and you're not making any progress for that, as far as increase, again, it's, I think with a plan, with a financing plan, you're better able to argue your discretionary immunity than if you don't have a plan.
My general feeling is that I think this is something that is necessary, and I'd like to go forward with it as quickly as possible, but there's just a lot of details that we have to work out as a group.
Agreed. So it sounds like we have some questions that would be, and any other question could be shared with staff, and we get those responses. Yeah. Do we set a date and bring this back? Or because, again, Richard gave us a kind of an out that said we could push this off to the next year if you wanted, but I don't know that that's prudent either.
I think we ought to put a date on it.
Yes.
We should do it in May sometime since he needs to figure if it's go or not by June.
Okay.
So this multiplier, I think this is the gorilla or the elephant, depending on how you want to look at it.
I think you'll find there are more.
What is the, strategy we think we want to pick for coming to some conclusion on that?
Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, I understand that the multiplier is a way to differentiate, take from the top to the bottom, commercial to residential, but I think something based on valuation might be more appropriate because, again, I don't think the actual, unlike car traffic, I'm not sure trip generation, certainly between like the lower end, multifamily and single family, I'm not sure that's what wears out sidewalks as much as settling and heave and whatever. But I do agree there probably needs to be a differentiation, but I'm not sure that it's the multiplier. Perhaps something based on value.
Right. And I do like how you collapse the 51 down to 4. That's a step in the right direction, in my opinion. But it sounds like we're adding, and this goes to Mr. Ruska's point, we're adding a little bit of gradation within those four categories to perhaps allow for valuation.
There can be two multipliers too, right? I mean, there can be commercial class and then also evaluation class, right?
You could have 10 classifications if you want. I mean, you could have as many as you want to.
Sure, but it should make sense. Though. Mr. Spade,
I think the integral of the
one option. You utilizing value in some way, shape, or form as a potential option. Maybe doing something similar to how the downtown special services district levy to the various properties is attributed to them, and that is it has a market value, and based on that market value and the tax capacity rate, the tax capacity of that parcel, for instance, then if Richard needs to plug in $3.6 million, each, you come up with a multiplier factor that goes against the tax capacity of each of those particular parcels to come up with the dollar amount to each parcel. It's that's how the downtown SSD levy is calculated each year.
Because tax capacity is essentially what you were talking about.
Oh, yeah. And I think there's some other variables, though, too. You've got properties that are brand new and probably had just invested in versus properties that are 30 years old that probably need some work. So, how do you treat that fair? And then also, what if someone just had some panels replaced, and now, you know, I mean, they're going to be paying again. So, you know, there's a lot of the variables that I see that need to be considered to try to make this implemented in a fair way.
I have two
got some hands up over there.
Nailed it.
One of the things is using value. I'll defer to the city attorney, but the words that are in here are real estate classification. There's no indication that you have any latitude outside of that real estate classification in assigning a uniform cost. As far as if you just did some and had to pay for some, we are, in our past 6-7 years, we've been cycling through the city. Southwest is what we'd inspect this year for a 17 program. So if you are in the district that is going to be worked on this year, it will be 5 years before we'll be there. We would have that as the last district.
So we won't be right back in a neighborhood that we've done.
Mm-hmm. The assessment, 5 years. The assessment would be immediate, though, right?
Yes.
I mean, yeah. I guess that was the key, is we cycle around every 5 years, but everyone is always paying because that's how we're building up the pool.
Somebody was first and somebody was last, and it's just, again, it's almost impossible to come up with a way to make it better other than to try to at least move around the city in the same general pattern that we did before. So if we were in a district... last year, we won't be there for 5 years.
And in theory, the district, the first district you visit, the last time the city was there was 19 years ago, right? The last cycle of the 20-year cycle.
Yeah.
We currently have just two topics scheduled for May 23rd. Would you want to bring it back then, set the date, and bring it back with some of these questions answered?
If you set a date like May 23rd, could we get maybe your questions ahead of time? So
yes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Sure. Oh, you're getting them.
Yeah. I would expect that.
Yeah. I do not feel like I understand what we've asked staff to provide. I mean, do you guys feel equipped here? Because, like, the multiplier thing, I understand the desire to go look at some other qualifications. Will you all provide some examples of what those tables could look like to us?
The multiplier, we can sit here in a room and change those, and that'll give you dollars and cents.
We do have another community that John found on the internet, Ithaca, New York, that does this, very similar to what we're doing. And so what I'm going to do, and John's and Doug's assistants, and learn a little bit more about what they did, and what worked, what didn't work there, and I don't know how the law in New York works compared to the law in Minnesota, but this is an example that we have found that we probably could get some more information from.
That would be good.
And their rate is either 7 or 7.5 a month.
And the one I'd really like to see is what we can do with the tax capacity, because that is, you know, intended to alleviate and make things supposed to be equitable. So if there's something where we can use the tax capacity to at least figure out what the multiplier should be based on the tax capacity, that might be something we can do as well. But okay. Staff can do that, prepare that for us. I'd appreciate having that.
Okay. Mr. Hick?
Yeah, and I don't want to, this all sounds interesting. I don't want to rain on the parade here, but I would still be interested if we could get some more information. If this has been available to communities for 40 years and no one does it, I mean, do a little bit more asking around what have been some of the problems so we don't repeat that.
I'm not sure it's been a problem. I think what the anecdotal things that we did hear a little bit is that the speculation it was the property tax argument.
Okay.
We put it on the taxes.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
None of the cities that I talked to, and I tried to reach out to as many as I could, actually reach to an implementation stage.
So I'm hearing we're going to share questions with staff, and I'm also hearing we're going to take a look at another, maybe a comparable model at another in another community, and we're also going to take a look at incorporating like valuation or tax capacity into the modeling to see what those numbers might look like. Those three items that I'm hearing.
And when are we bringing it back?
May 23rd is when. So hopefully we can get certainly with the questions shared, but then hopefully get some of the responses back so we'll be able to do our respective homework and then come in on the 23rd ready to have some discussion.
So again, I just ask you to maybe look at this chart a little bit and give us maybe some ideas on, and if you notice on this chart, the left column,
there is only one classification for commercial. Mm-hmm. There is only one. So again, I think we'll maybe have to work a little bit with Terry on this to see as it might relate to the language in the statute that talks about property tax classification. The county only has one. Can we actually do anything different there? But those are the type of things. There's all sorts of residential and federal and parkland and this and that, but I only see the word commercial here once.
All right. All right, we will continue that topic again on the 23rd. Thank you very much. Mr. Reeves,
you're up. You want me to go?
Sure. Save the best for last.
Depends how much you like sidewalks.
I really love sidewalks.
I will definitely try to be brief in terms of time. I had provide the memo in the package with kind of the basics. I'll try to touch on just some of the bigger project things besides the obvious operations of the department. On a daily basis, it's basically we take all the questions and walk in to come to the city. We deal with all the parking ticket issues, which there are a number of, assessments, admin fines, licenses and permits, records retentions, and this year, of course, our big issue is elections. I'll kind of run through some of the bigger things. We talked about this last year when I did the report. We were implementing the laser fiche system, which is our document management system. That is still ongoing. I do have some information here as far as, kind of what we've done to date. Other departments are doing a lot with laser fiche now as well. They're doing back scanning of all their documents, things like that. So we are finally creating that one repository for all the city documents historically and moving forward. So at some point here, we will have kind of a filled-in system where we can easily, anyone can search through it, find what they need, documents, contracts, building plans, whatever it might be. So it's moving. We're seeing actually really good progress with it now that the infrastructure in place. As far as from my offices, we are rolling out right now the electronic signing of all the contracts, agreements, things like that that the city does. We've been doing for a while now the resolutions and ordinances. Now we're moving into these contracts. So we're kind of sitting down with each of the departments that generate contracts, kind of walking through how this is going to work, what we have to do. The biggest issue with this is that we do generate contracts, but they need to be signed by third parties. So we have to use a system, another software system that verifies the third party signing. So like when we have a construction contract and we prepare the contract, we send it out to the contractor's company to sign it. We do use a third party. We're using eSign Live, but there's various ones. We look through them all. But that way we have a legal way to back up that, yes, this was electronically signed, all those sort of things. So we've worked extensively with Terry on this one. Today he's not here. I'm sure he'd love to talk about it. We're moving it forward, ready to roll it out now, so that'll be being implemented soon. The mayor's not here, but I think he'll appreciate the fact that this morning we brought up to him, I think, 60 things that he needed to sign. So we're moving towards, from now on, he'll be able to do like he does with resolution ordinances, which is just click OK, review, click OK, review, click OK, and we'll move it through the process. Biggest part of all that is it also lets people track it, so I don't get the emails I just got one while sitting here from RPU asking about where a contract was. They can pull it up in the process. They can see who's waiting on it. It might be waiting on a third party. It might be waiting on the mayor. So we'll have much better tracking. And then it also then integrates into our document management system. So when the final contract is signed, it gets archived. So it's easily trackable within our system. It's stored away. We put a retention schedule on it right away. So we know that depending on what the contract is, 10 years from now, it will be deleted out of our system. We won't have it sitting around anymore. So that's moving forward. We're also taking a look at other ways to use laser fiche. We've talked about, right now we're doing ordinances resolutions already, so a good example of that is when an ordinance gets signed by the mayor, it automatically generates and sends a notice to the Post Bulletin to publish it. So it's no longer having to take it, save a document, scan it in, send it to the Post Bulletin, all that stuff. It automatically generates it, the Post Bulletin gets it as soon as the mayor signs it. All that's kind of happening right now. Same thing with findings of fact. One step we don't have in findings of fact yet is automatically sending it off to the developer that applied, but we're getting there. We're going to have to work on integration a little bit yet, but basically when a findings of fact will get signed, it'll automatically just email it out to that developer that whose project it is. So they get it right away, those sort of things. So all that's sort of happening right now. We're using it to update the city ordinances. So right now when a city ordinance gets updated, updated and automatically send it out to all the departments saying the ordinance has been updated, here's the pages, all that sort of stuff. So it's being used really well right now. It's working out well. And like I said, we're going to keep building off that. We're doing the migration. Like I talked about, the next big project that I'm working on will be with Public Works and kind of with Admin, basically. But we're migrating all their files into it. So if you look, like in my conference room right now, it's all basically JProject construction files. We're going to work on back scanning all those and getting the historical documents there. So that's going on. LaserFiche has a way that we can handle all of our data practice requests. We're getting a growing number of data practice requests, but we don't have a central way to track them. So we're looking at using LaserFiche because there's a simple module where people can go online, they can submit a data practice request, automatically gets routed to the right departments with my review. We can respond through it, and we can also generate any invoices that we might have for the cost for the request through as well. So we're working on getting that rolled out this year as well. Electronic bids. We're working with Public Works on that right now. We're trying to figure out which is the best way to go because they do have an electronic process right now where they release bids out. But we want to take that the next step where not only can a contractor, whoever wants to bid on a project, go to the EGRAM site and pull off the electronic copy, that or version of that bid, but then they're also going to have to, they're going to submit bids electronically as well. We no longer want to get the paper bids that come in. We have to time stamp them, all those sort of things. There'll be an electronic process to for all the contractors and whoever it might be to submit bids for projects, for RFPs, for those sort of things. So we're rolling that out with Public Works right now. IT is working on that. Dale's not here either, but IT's been great with that. Dale is here. Sorry, Dale.
Dale is hard to see today. I
missed him. He was in a different spot. It's your Dale is here. So I need to definitely thank Dale and IT, especially Carl Hunter, who does all the LaserFiche work. He's been great, and Dale's been great along in the time to work on all these things because it's the system's all there, but you need somebody to sit down with the departments, work through the workflow, set it all up, test it, run it, go in to do training, all that stuff. Carl's been great. I will support Dale when he wants to hire another Carl because I think it'll speed things up with other departments too. I don't know if they request that or not, but I will because she has done a great job with it. So it's been going really well. I appreciate all the support that IT's given with all these things. A couple other things with it, we talked about just some basic stuff. With an election year, I mean, we have a roster. This year, we're going to push for roughly 1,000 election judges. We expect a very high turnout. We're going to need a lot more judges in certain locations than we usually have. So to do that right now, it's really a paper-based system, mailing things out. I mean, we have a spreadsheet with tracking, but that's it. We're moving all that into LaserFiche, so we'll have some automatic mailers. So every election year, at the beginning of the year, we'll automatically send out letters to everybody on our election judge roster with a link to an online form that lets them renew if they want to be a judge again, submit any updates, those sort of things. Clearly, with our election judges, technology use is varies widely, so we'll still have to do a lot of paper-based documents for our judges, but if we can move a lot of our internal processing to LaserFiche, at least it'll save us a lot of steps as far as the mailings and things like that. So we're working towards that. Because we have such a big roster this year, it's a kind of a slow process, but we are going to get that done. And then the goal of the LaserFiche system really is automate how we do things, try to eliminate as much of the hand work that we need to do with contracts and documents, with whatever it is, and then just kind of have a process in place where it just routes it around to people, you can track it, and then in the end it gets sent out to whoever needs to see it, it gets stored away, and then we can find it when we need to. So that's all going really well. Another big update has been our assessment software with LOGIS. Again, that's a big one with finance and with Public Works. But we also it also touches pretty much all the departments. Parks is involved, building safety is involved. It's a much better system now where the individual departments, whenever they decide they want to, can enter assessments into the system. The system will automatically generate the notices that get printed out to be mailed out to the people that we're assessing. It can be for sidewalk repair, it can be for grass mowing, it can be for whatever. It'll automatically send the notice to the post bulletin to be published, all those sort of things. So again, it's a great system. We're a little new into it, so everybody's still kind of learning the process and things, but the other good side of it is ultimately it'll open it up where all the assessment searches we get right now, people can just go online and look. They can pull up a parcel address. They can see everything that's been certified for assessment. They can see everything that's pending. They can see any special notes, all that sort of stuff. I think it'll make things a lot easier for our closing companies and just any property owner that wants to see where they stand on a property with assessment. So that's being rolled out now. It's going real well so far. The Tech Integration Committee, we had just an all-day meeting last Friday. Again, that's what we've been talking about. We're trying to get a little more consolidation and cooperation with the city, with the police department, with the library, with RPU, simple things like a shared email system, a calendaring system, to much, much bigger pictures about how do we purchase software programs in the city, how do we make sure that we're not buying a duplicate system that's out there that can be modified, all those sort of things. So it's a real big process. It's going very well, again. And we're seeing some progress on that, and we're going to be bringing that back to the council here soon, I think, in a committee of the whole for an update. So you'll get more on that soon. Another big one is the parking technology. We've switched over to Duncan. We've had some issues with the rollover, but it's getting cleared up. It's automated that process a lot better as well. So when we get parking tickets and they go to warrant and they have to get sent out and people paying online, those sort of things, it's a new system. We've worked out, I think, most of the issues with it. So the next step is the license plate readers for our residential permit parking. Right now, we have a lot of permits out there. They're hard permits. They're either the ones that get attached to license plates or they're the paper ones for temporaries and things. We get a lot of reports of abuse of the system, of selling of permits, of sharing of permits, those sort of things. We're moving to strictly a license plate based system. We're in the integration of that right now. The plan is that we roll through the system on July 1st, we move to the license plate based system. So not only will we be able, we have no more physical permits whatsoever, everything will be license plate based, but we'll also be able to narrow it down where if there's someone that offers music lessons, they will provide us with all the license plate numbers of their students, parents, and they're allowed to be in the neighborhood parking between the hours of 5 and 8, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, or whatever it might be. We can set days, we can set times, all these sort of things in it, and it will definitely cut down on the issues that we're having right now. It'll allow us a lot more control. It'll also allow us to do a lot more with our residential permit program. We can set special zones for any number of things that we want to. We're already working on a special zone for some of the schools. We have ongoing issues with parking around schools for volunteers, for teachers, things like that. Right now, there's not a good way to handle that. Parking control is very labor-intensive to have to drive around, check a permit that's posted in the window. It says it's a teacher, park here. Did the school make that? Did we make that? Where does this come from? No more. It'll just drive by. If the license plate reader gets something, it'll ping up. It'll pop up on their screen, and they can issue a ticket. So, like I said, July 1 is a goal that should be up and running. It'll really help things a lot. It'll take care of a lot of the issues that I hear from you council members as far as residential permit concerns and things. So that's going well. Last couple, electronic licensing. Right now, my department has a different system for all the licenses and permits we do. I'm going to transition that over to Acela. Now that Acela's is much further down the line, they've got the online payment portal and all those things worked out, I'm going to move my system onto Acela. We've already got the major investment in Acela. It's a much more robust system to use. So we'll be dropping mine. We'll be transitioning that. It just kind of makes sense. We've just been waiting for the online payment aspect to pick up. And then finally, when we talk about all this stuff, it's really the open data. So when somebody from the public wants to find some information, where do they find it? Right now, they've got to basically make a data practice request. We've got to deal with it that way. The goal is to create a site with all this information that's coming in the LaserFiche and all the information that's going into LOGIS and in these different programs, Acela, whatever it might be, make whatever is public accessible. And the goal for me, honestly, is to cut down the data practice requests. If a citizen wants to find something, I want to create a spot where they can go in and fairly easily find any public data that they're looking for. And that way we can start cutting these requests really down to specific, interesting, unique situations, possibly things that contain non-public data that we'd have to redact, that sort of stuff. So that's being moved forward to, but it doesn't make sense to have it unless you have some place where you can click to and get to all this stuff. But we're finally laying that background infrastructure to be able to make all this data available to the public. And as that moves forward, we're going to open up the open data page. We'll make it there. OpenGov for financial sort of things. All that sort of stuff is being implemented. So once that's all in place, you then have somewhere where you can just make a page. People can go in and type in something they're looking for, and they can see where the different sources available in the city to get it. They can pull it up for free. It's readily available, no cost to us, that sort of thing. I think it'll make things a lot easier for the public, a lot easier for the newspaper, a lot easier for anyone to find the information that they're looking for. And to be very selfish, to cut down on a lot of time that we spend right now on data practice requests for things that are public, we just don't have a clearinghouse for them. So we're getting there. So that's kind of the basic update of where the department's at.
Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, that was an excellent presentation. Appreciate that. I had just a couple of questions. Now, the laser feed, obviously we have a huge investment as a city. So you know, a lot of the documents get scanned in, and it's a PDF. Just for the overall database, you know, let's say in the future there is some big change in laser fish, either became cost-prohibitive or for some reason we need to move to a different system. Is that database somewhat portable that we could potentially export it to a different vendor in the future?
It's all basically stored in a format that we can technically move it wherever we want to move it.
Okay.
LaserFish is really just the system that allows us to workflow it, process it, save it, and then search it, because it makes every word searchable, all searching. But technically, the base data itself, we can move around to wherever we want to.
It's a PDF document. It's on a SQL database with HTML links to the document.
Good. Then just one more question. This is probably more on the license plate technology than it is to our implementation. But just, you know, when those license plate scanners go, how quick can they move down the road? And that, it's got to be a tough angle to read a plate if it's parked close.
Yep, so they got the camera situated to hit whether it's parallel, whether it's angle. They have them where you can, if you got some weird vehicle that's parked really crazy, you can do a manual hit on it if you need to. But it's as quick as basically they drive down that street. It'll pick them up.
So does the enforcement officer then have to like kind of pan and zoom or
nothing.
Just kind of
they're all basically fixed and they have a wide angle kind of viewing sort of thing to it. They're fairly impressive when we saw the demo. They work really well.
Cool. Hopefully it works as good as the demo.
We always know.
they have to stop to print a ticket.
What's that?
They have to stop.
They'll have to stop. Once it hits it, right now we still have to place that physical ticket on the vehicle to make sure that it's there. But they'll get a hit and automatically then it'll explain what it is, and all they basically have to do is if there's any special information they want to put in there, they just hit the button and it generates a ticket with the offense and everything already on it because it knows what the offense is, but because it popped up
parking. Go ahead, Mr. Bildeback.
So are we going to have enough readers for all vehicles?
Right now we only have two of the three. We only have three parking control vehicles that we use, though. So we have two that we're rolling it out on to start with, and then we'll add the third as long as there's no issues, things like that.
So is that being paid for out of your group, or is it transportation?
Out of the parking funds, out of transit.
So why are we not doing all three?
The thought was we're going to do two. We're going to see how those two go, because they're kind of out on a regular basis. If it goes well, we're going to do three, and we may actually add a fourth vehicle and go to four. But two seem to be a reasonable rollout. And really, once we do the install on these, we have our staff with them on the install. So we should actually be able to install the additional ones on our own with minimal assistance from the vendor.
We saved one if we don't like them. That's why I like them.
I think you're going to like them. I mean, the fact is, we're going to be able to monitor things.
I tell you, we are going to be so unpopular in the cities of Byron and Stuartville when that thing goes live.
Oh my God.
Mr. Ruska, then Ms. Means, then Mr. Hickey.
Here, and kind of a separate subject. 4 or 5 years ago, we had quite a battle, emotional battle, over this charitable gambling receipts and expenditures, and we kind of, set that standard and move forward. But I haven't heard much back on it. Is this something that your department is monitoring at all, or reviewing it every year? And if there's any, because we aren't hearing about it, means that there's no discrepancies and everything's falling into place as it should.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest issue that we ever come up with is maybe somebody's late in a report, and we just have to do a follow up and say, we need to get this information in so we can finalize it. But we haven't had any problems with it. Definitely staying on top of it. We're reviewing it every year. Nope, I think whatever you did before you got here seems to be great. Yep, we're reviewing that part of it to make sure that they're in compliance.
All right.
Do we have any issues?
All right, Ms.
Means. It is pretty amazing the changes that have occurred under your leadership, and thank you very much, because it certainly increases efficiency, makes data more accessible. I am kind of curious about the public that might want to review data practices information. Where do they view that information?
So, I mean, and to get back to thank you for that, I mean, and I do have to say that it's been definitely an ongoing process. And sometimes it's more work to get to the more efficient part. So I definitely appreciate the different departments we have to work with, Dale and IT, and then just the other departments to work through it, and especially my staff. It's all new for them. I mean, their jobs, nobody's really doing the same job necessarily, especially doing it the same way that when I started. So they've been very good about that transition, and they're getting there, and it's been very good, and they've been on board with it. So I definitely thank the other departments and my staff for making this a lot easier, because it is sometimes harder to get to the better part. So we're getting there. But as far as the data practice request, we do have on the city clerk web, the city clerk page of the city website, we do have all of our kind of policies and request forms and things listed there. So if somebody wants to just see, you know, what's our policy on data, is there an application I can use, things like that, that's all there. So that's on the city website page there, but honestly, we get most of them just phone calls and emails. I want this information, I need this, and we just process them that way. And that's fine, it works out okay. And then as far as the viewing goes, we basically follow statutes. We either provide it to them on a paper copy, as an electronic format, or they can come in and view it in our office. We oftentimes have people in our conference room using that computer to view data practice requests. The Chateau Circle request, for example, since it's such a big request, it's kind of an ongoing request. Basically, once a month, a neighborhood association representative just stops in and reviews everything we have for that month. They ask for copies. If they want a copy, we charge them the 25 cents a page and something like that. So we do everything we can to make it kind of as easy as possible. But right now, the biggest issue is the delays. We get multiple requests from multiple areas, and it takes a while to pull it all together. That's why we're looking at using LaserFiche to consolidate the request process and then automate it, so it just gets it sent out to the right departments right away, generates their own notifications to them that, oh yeah, you haven't responded to this in a week, or yeah, with it, that sort of stuff. Because right now it kind of falls on me to remind the departments, oh hey, I'm waiting for this, and honestly, it sometimes falls behind a few weeks before I remember, oh yeah, we got a request waiting out there.
Your conference room is pretty well used. I even got booted out of the conference room because of someone else needing to use it.
Yeah.
But it's pretty congested in there.
Yep.
So what do you plan to do about that?
The goal is that we're doing the backfilling. Most of those files, like I said, are those J files, those construction project files. So we're actually going to get all those scanned into LaserFiche so they can all leave there. And that'll basically open up that whole room. And then our goal, actually, if we can make it work, is to separate it into at least two rooms for the data viewing. So we had so many requests, and some of these requests are huge, and they can be expensive. So people would rather just view the data. So we'd rather split into two, have kind of two little workstations set up in there where we can use them for conference rooms if we have to, like when you're there and you want to meet with someone, or like when Bethany meets with a lot of our licensing people that need help with their, you know, permit renewals and license renewals. We could have a room ready for that, and we could have another room always open for these data practice requests and stuff. So that's the goal of that space, is to try to make better use of it. We don't need, it's taken up right now with all these paper files. We don't need those in there, so we're going to get them scanned and out of there. The hard part is those are files that are accessed on almost a daily basis by different departments. So we can't get them out of there until we have them somewhere else where they can find them. So that's the goal of the back scanning, is to get that room opened up and clear up some space to allow for more public use in there for looking at data and things like that.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Hickey.
Just one more quick question, just back to the data for the license plate scanners. What databases do we access? So for different states and such?
Whatever the police department uses, however they kind of do it now for if they want a plate,
okay.
It's the police department doing it. I mean, okay. It's Parking Control Division, but it's the police sure. department doing it. So whatever it is that they use, they'll be able to access those same databases.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Anything else? Thank you. It sounds like you've been busy.
That's great.
I would just like to remember this presentation when we get to mine.
Yes.
Welcome to our United Data Department.
Yes.
Hire a whole new one.
None of this happens without Dale's department, trust me.
Yeah.
None of this happens without Dale.
You can't see. You're still sitting there. You started talking nicely.
That's right.
I heard you ran out of mom.
Sorry, I didn't hear
you. You said you look like you were like one thing.
I was going to talk to
you. She's such a beauty. I'm sorry. The Bob Norman, he sent an email to everyone on the council with a few proposals for the neighborhood thing that's going to be coming back next week. Just I want to make sure we're going to be
able to get
information.
Oh, yes. Boy, she's
so highly. I'm excited to see her. She was involved at the school. My kids were there. My Johnson, yeah.
I'm not trying to take him out of the moment.
Yeah, I'm Johnson. I just
stay here and hang around. There you go.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know they decided.